The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Toby Dichter, and I'm chair of the board of the foundation that sponsors this lecture and others. I'm also the daughter of Amelia Gordon, who's this is her memorial lecture. And I'm also a passionate advocate of this phenomenal institution, as I know many of you are. It's so nice to see so many friendly faces. Tonight, I think, is really a snapshot of what the library is today, right? This is knowledge brokers, knowledgeable people bringing us access to the best and the brightest. And we're here to witness this, and we are so privileged. And it's access to so many: culture, learning, programs that we would never have a chance to see and never have access to otherwise. So many of you have been very generous already. We thank you so much, but the democracy of knowledge is an ongoing business. And so if you would please consider making a contribution to the library as often as you can, just go to the website. It's a good website. It has a lot on it, and it's freelibrary.org, and make a contribution. It really will help sustain the 54 neighborhood libraries and our largest branch, which is cyberspace. So we're probably here tonight because we love the writing and the iconoclasm of these two authors, right? We're intrigued by the inside story of the fatwa. Joseph Anton, Mr. Rushdie's invented name for himself during those 10 years of hiding, carries us through the fatwa and its backstory. He somehow manages to make his subjective autobiography into the most interesting objective narrative, and very fluidly. It's a wonderful read. So in the book, he tells about having a story that he told about challenging authority, and he mentions in the book that this was part of his commencement address at Bard College. Well, Mark and I were sitting there in the audience on that sunny afternoon in 1996 as we heard the whir of the helicopter land behind the trees with a guest so mysterious that not even the graduates knew who the speaker was. Mr. Rushdie had risked his appearance during the Khomeini fatwa, calling for his death to deliver the message, "Stand up for your rights." What he actually said was this: "Don't take the rap if you're unjustly accused. Those who would reject you because you're not wearing the right shoes are not worth being accepted by, and kneel before no man." Among his 12 novels and countless essays, Martin Amis, who is the bad boy of Britain, he's such a delightful, irreverent writer, he wrote a memoir of his own, which in addition to tonight's book is really a poignant, wonderful read. And 23 years ago, he happened to write a piece in Vanity Fair called Rendezvous with Salman Rushdie. So they're a beautifully compatible pair of funny, irreverent chroniclers who turn fiction into nonfiction and nonfiction into stories. How privileged we are to eavesdrop between the two of them tonight and hear them one at a time and then together and then to answer our questions. Because when you throw everything up in the air, anything becomes possible. That's a line from the Satanic Verses. So turn off your phones now and tune in. And later on, you can encourage others to tune into the podcast as well, as we welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia two titans of the literary world, Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie. And first, we're going to hear from the irrepressible Martin Amis. Thank you.
Good evening. like to say thank you to the folks upstairs who facilitated this event, and to say that public libraries are everything. They're the key to all free cultures. And as Saul Bellow said, when he started going to libraries at the age of 12 and 13, and just was amazed that all this was there for him. And the later formulation of his, the universal eligibility to be noble, and that's what libraries give everyone access to. I want to talk about Christopher Hitchens for a bit and about the many hours of pleasure and profit, innocent pleasure and profit I had with him playing rather deplorable word games with obscene connotations. And if there's anyone who's very easily upset, they should leave now. Salman would also join in these frolics, and Ian McEwan also. And just to give you an example of how quick-witted my friend Salman is, we were having a session of trying to rename important books and works of art in the style of Robert Ludlum, all of whose titles are like The Eiger Sanction, you know, a place name followed by a sort of crappy noun. And I said to Salman, what about Hamlet? He said, the Elsinore Vacillation. And I said, what about Macbeth? The Dunsinane Deforestation. Although we ran into trouble on that just the other week, because I alerted, well, I said, in fact, the woods go from Dunsinane. And the Dunsinane Forestation, not nearly as good. This is how it sort of gets going. I've just been in San Fernando Valley writing a piece about pornography. And I interviewed John Stagliano of Buckman fame. And there I was out by the porno pool with John, with the porno convertible parked nearby and the porno sand and the porno Pacific Ocean on porno lounges. And with some hesitation, I asked John why in his work there was this incredible concentration on anal sex. And he said with a limp shrug, he said, pussies are bullshit, he said. And I said, would you care to elaborate on that? And he said, well, he said, you know, with vaginal, he said, they're all, you know, making a noises. And you think, is this for real? Or is it bullshit? His face lightened, and he said, with anal, their personality comes out. So I had dinner with Salman and Hitchens and others, and we thought, if pussies are bullshit, then bullshit is pussy. So we were floundering around saying, you know, bullshit in boots, and we weren't really getting anywhere with it. And then I think I said, what about the heroine of the James Bond novel Goldfinger? Bullshit galore. That's not bad. And then there was a pause, and Salman's eyes lit up, and he said, octo-bullshit. But we soon came to the end of that one. Others, I went over with Hitchens for decades, refining them, and for instance, replacing the word love in titles and of songs and novels with hysterical sex. So it's deromanticizing is the sort of tendency, and as Hitchens often said, it has to be subversive. So hysterical sex is a many splendid thing. Hysterical sex in the time of cholera. It gets more deplorable now. Love, that's love as a noun. Love as a verb is replaced by the most common synonym for sexual activity, the one that begins with an F and ends with a CK and it's got a U in the middle. Again, James Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. Elvis's Love Me Tender. Or the popular TV show I Love Lucy. Variant on this was that heart would be replaced by another synonym for the male member, the one that begins with D and ends in CK with an I in the middle. And in fact, when Hitch was in having some terrible chemo treatment, the nurse, he'd written about this in Vanity Fair, and the nurse said, just came up to him and whispered, my heart belongs to Daddy. But, you know, heart like a wheel, etc. Heart of darkness. But Salman often mentions this at readings because what he wants is fun, but he doesn't know the half of it because when it's a female song title or novel, then I'm afraid to say that that word beginning with D is replaced by a three-letter word, box. So it would be My Box Belongs to Daddy. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Stop in the Name of Hysterical Sex. Before You Break My... Stop. I'd just like to say that Hitch's death was a disaster, but I now think that he loved life so much that he never went to sleep. So, in fact, he lived to 75, not 61. His day was so much longer than ours. And also that after his death, that love of life of his became a sacred duty to continue that in all his friends. And I think this is quite widely felt by his friends, that their love of life has increased since he died. It's survivors' glee, in a way, but it's also a way of honouring him because it becomes a duty to love life as much as he did. Now I'm just going to read for 5 minutes from Lionel Asbow. What you need to know is that Lionel Asbow is a very violent but not very successful criminal, subsistence criminal in London, who wins £140 million on the lottery. And he becomes part of that social group called Lotto Louts, followed around by the press everywhere. And they're all tend to be lotto louts because the only people who go in for the lotto are louts and young criminals. And he's just come out of prison and he was in prison when he won the money. And he's giving his brothers dinner in, as it might be, the Savoy. And all you need to know is that he comes from a rather, well, that he hates his mother because of the dysfunctional family he's from. And he never gives you anything if you ask for it. So his brothers, he's got five brothers, and his mother had all these brothers and Lionel and a girl before she was old enough to vote. She was 18 and she had six children. So there they are in the Savoy Grill. The brothers are called John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Stuart, the forgotten Beatle. There was a New Yorker piece that said that it would be good if the whole male population of the world were divided into either Johns, Pauls, Georges, or Ringos. It might simplify certain things like, for instance, a court case where you could say, I submit, Your Honor, that this is far too complicated a crime for a Ringo to commit. Now, this is Lionel. They're having dinner, about to have dinner. How do you get an upper-class chump to burn his face? Go on, then. Phone him when he's doing the ironing. An upper-class chump goes into a pub with a, excuse me, sir, are you ready to order? Said the bearded waiter. for the seventh or eighth time. And the bearded waiter, though young, was, as Lionel saw it, an upper-class chump. Hang on. An upper-class chump goes into a pub with a heap of wet dog shit in his hand. He says to the barman, "Look what I nearly stepped in." How many upper-class chumps does it take to... Wait up. Concentrate, lads. They were dining in the Grosvenor Grill. It was now just after 10. "Well, it stares you in the face, doesn't it?" said Lionel. "Steak and chips." "Plain as day," said John. "Open and shut," said Paul. "Common sense," said George. "No-brainer," said Ringo. Stuart, on this occasion, was silent, but then Stuart, a seedy registrar, hardly ever said anything anyway. "That one'll do," said Lionel, pointing to the filet mignon. And did these young men, evenly spaced round the glistening lips of the white tabletop, did they resemble a band of brothers? No. They shared a mother, true, but Grace Pepperdine's genetic footprint was vanishingly light, and the boys were all duplicates of their fathers. So John, 29, looked Nordic. Paul, 28, looked Hispanic. George, 27, looked Belgic or Afrikaan. And Ringo, also 27, looked East Asiatic. Only Stuart, 26, and of course Lionel, 25, looked English, though Stuart was in fact half Silesian. John, Paul, George, and Ringo, at any rate, wore the same threadbare zoot suits and had the same hairstyle, slashbacks with long sideburns that tapered to a point. "How would you like that cooked, sir?" "Cooked," said Lionel. "Just take its horns off, wipe its ass, and sling it on the plate. And bring all you jams and pickles and mustards. Us against the world, eh, lads?" It did not escape Lionel's notice that when he went out for his tri-hourly smokes, he always returned to five strained faces and a sudden stoppered hush. And he knew all about their difficulties, John, Paul, and George, with their bad debts and cramped flats, their shattered wives, their rioting toddlers, Ringo with his decayed on the dole, and Stuart, who alone could probably look forward to some kind of pension, sharing a bedsit with a bus conductor in SE24. Now Lionel invited the company to raise their glasses. He thought that everything was coming along quite nicely. "Why did the upper-class chump cross the road?" he resumed. "Go on, then." The brothers had between them, 48 gin and tonics. After the meal, there are a few incidents at the meal, but after the meal, they go out into the hotel garden. No one's dared ask him for money at this point. "There's tension in the air, lads," said Lionel, as he followed the fairy lights up the garden path with his brandy balloon and his cigar. "Bound to be. I mean, look around. This ain't Diston. This ain't KFC. Everything's different now." Lionel heard the gulp of five Adam's apples in five shriveled throats. "Tension, it's only natural. You kid brother's been tipped the wink by Lady Luck, and you asking yourself, what's he going to do for his own?" Lionel heard the soft seethe of five intakes of breath. "John, Paul, George, Ringo, Stuart, you lives are about to be transformed." Lionel turned, five pairs of feet staggered back. "Your number one headache, from now on, completely taken care of. You needn't give it another thought, ever. That shadow that never goes away, that nagging concern that wakes you up in the middle of the night, a thing of the past, over." Lionel looked forgivingly from face to face. "And what's that worry? Well, come on, let's not be shy. Begins with an M. Say it, M-M-M. Lionel lifted his gaze to the night sky. "Mum," he said. The brothers, as pale, still, and silent as the statues. "Mum, mum, our mum, in her declining years, she's 40. What's going to become of mum? They're not having our mum, mate." Lionel dipped his head and wiped his eyes. He sniffed richly. "Ah, look, I can see the lovely glow in you faces. You feeling better already? knowing I'll take care of Mum. Our Mum. Us against the world, eh, lads? Us for Mum. So, stunned hugs in the foyer, then one after the other, the five Pepperdines shot out through the revolving doors, ran a brief sprint, and stumbled to a halt, sharply watched by Lionel Asbo, whose head abruptly jerked forward as something interesting seemed to develop with a skeleton staff of press. But it was just Stuart rebounding off a lamppost and falling over backwards, and John and George kneeling down to be sick. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Martin and Christopher invented all the dirty games. He and I invented some cleaner ones. I mean, my favourite one is just titles that don't quite make it, you know. Mr. Zhivago. Toby Dick, you know. for which the alternative title is Moby Prick. Farewell to Weapons, turned into, yeah, For Whom the Bell Rings, you know, so on. We could do this all night, which we usually did, and it's kind of sad that those evenings will never come again, except in these kind of revivifications of them, which we can't stop doing. I'm just going to read two little bits from my memoir, Joseph Anton, one funny and one less funny. Just in case you don't know, the memoir is written in the third person to be a little more novelistic, I suppose, to be able to treat myself like a character in the story rather than just as me. Anyway, this is about when, in the middle of the whole saga, there was a point when I was first able to come to the United States. This is a couple of years in, and I was asked to address a free speech conference at Columbia University. And I showed up, and the NYPD got very excited. And this is what happened. He was met on the tarmac at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey by a 9-car motorcade with motorcycle outriders. The central car was an armored white stretch limo. That was his car. In charge of the very large number of NYPD officers involved was Lieutenant Bob Kennedy, known for the day as Hudson Commander. Lieutenant Bob introduced himself and explained the scenario, often breaking off to speak into his sleeve. Roger, Hudson, look out. This is Hudson Commander out. Roger that, over and out. Policemen nowadays spoke the way they had seen policemen speak on TV. Lieutenant Bob, it was clear, thought he was in a major movie. We'll be moving you through the city to the hotel in this vehicle right here, he said, redundantly, as the motorcade set off. Lieutenant Bob, he said, this is a lot. The 9 vehicles, the motorbikes, the sirens, the flashing lights, all of these officers, wouldn't it actually be safer just to drive me through the back streets in a used Buick? Lieutenant Bob looked at him with the pitying look people reserve for the chronically stupid or insane. No, sir, it would not, he replied. Who else would you do something like this, something on this scale for, Lieutenant Bob? Sir, this right here is what we do for Arafat. It was something of a shock to be bracketed with the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Lieutenant Bob, if I was the president, how much more would you do? Sir, if you were the president of these United States, sir, we'd close down a whole bunch of these side streets here, and sir, we'd have snipers on the rooftops along the route, but in your case, we didn't think that that was necessary because it would look too conspicuous. The inconspicuous 9-vehicle motorcade. rolled towards Manhattan with motorcycle sirens blaring, and lights flashing, attracting no attention at all. So we get to the hotel. There's an episode where Allen Ginsberg shows up and insists that we all meditate, which we have to do surrounded by these men with giant Terminators. And a little while later, Elizabeth, that's my, subsequently my wife, the mother of my younger son, Elizabeth arrived, and Lieutenant Bob brought her in to see him, surrounded by armed men. "It's okay, Lieutenant Bob," he said. "Elizabeth's cool. Elizabeth's with me." Lieutenant Bob narrowed his eyes. "If I wanted to kill you, sir," he said insanely, wearing his best crazy Jack Nicholson look, "she's exactly who I'd said." "How so, Lieutenant Bob?" He gestured towards a table on which there was an arrangement of fruits and cheeses, as well as cutlery and plates. "Sir, if she were to take one of those forks there and stab you in the neck, I'd lose my job." So, Andrew Wiley, this my literary agent, was finding it difficult to keep a straight face, and Elizabeth was known as the mad forkist for the rest of the trip. That evening, they were in the armored white stretch limo in the middle of the nine-vehicle motorcade with the motorcycle outriders and the sirens and flashing lights zooming down 125th Street towards the Columbia campus at 60 miles an hour, with the whole of Harlem standing out on the sidewalk watching the low-profile operation ghost almost imperceptibly by. And Andrew Wiley was screaming with delight at the outrageousness of it all. "This is the best day of my life." Then the fun, the slightly hysterical black comedy fun, was over. He was concealed behind a curtain at the low library, and when his name was announced, there was a shocked gasp, and he moved forward out of invisibility into the light. The lights were in his eyes, and he couldn't see the room. He had no idea who was there, but he had his speech to make. Once the speech was over, America unceremoniously threw him out. That same night, actually. He didn't even get a night in Manhattan on that occasion. It was a strange, one of the strangest things about those years, which Martin was very much a part of, a great helper and ally, is that very often it was simultaneously funny and not funny. You know, and that was one of the bizarre qualities of it, that you could see at the very moment that something was happening that really wasn't funny at all, that it was actually, if it hadn't been not funny, it would have been very funny. And that double vision, you know, came often. But anyway, this is a moment, just a brief reflection in the aftermath of the, well, in the near future, after the 9/11 attacks. The story of his little battle was coming to an end. The prologue was past, and now the world was grappling with the main event. It would have been easy after everything that had happened to him and after the enormity of the crime against the city to succumb to hatred of the religion in whose name these things were done and of its adherents too. Anyone who looked even vaguely Arab experienced some of that backlash in those weeks and months of aftermath. Young men wore T-shirts reading, "Don't blame me, I'm Hindu." Drivers of yellow cabs, many of whom had Muslim names, decked out their taxis with flags and patriotic decals to ward off their passengers' rage. But in this matter of wrath, too, the city on the whole showed restraint. The many were not held guilty of the crimes of the few. And he, too, refused anger. Rage made you the creature of those who enraged you. It gave them too much power. Rage killed the mind, and now more than ever the mind needed to live, to find a way of rising above the mindlessness. He chose to believe in human nature and in the universality of its rights and ethics and freedoms, and to stand against the fallacies of relativism that were at the heart of the invective of the armies of the religions. "We hate you because we aren't like you." And of their fellow travelers in the West, too, many of whom, disappointingly, were on the left. If the art of the novel revealed anything, it was that human nature was the great constant in any culture, in any place, in any time. and that, as Heraclitus had said 2,000 years earlier, a man's ethos, his way of being in the world, was his daimon, the guiding principle that shaped his life. Or in the pithier, more familiar formulation of the idea that character was destiny. It was hard to hold on to that idea while the smoke of death stood in the sky over Ground Zero, and the murders of thousands of men and women whose characters had not determined their fates were on everyone's mind. It hadn't mattered if they were hard workers or generous friends or loving parents or great romantics. The planes hadn't cared about their ethos. And yes, now terrorism could be destiny. War could be destiny. Our lives were no longer wholly ours to control. But still, our sovereign natures needed to be insisted on, perhaps more than ever. And the horror, it was important to speak up for individual human responsibility, to say that the murderers were morally responsible for their crimes, and neither their faith nor their rage at America was any excuse. It was important at a time of gargantuan, inflated ideologies, not to forget the human scale, to continue to insist on our essential humanity, to go on making love, so to speak, in a combat zone. In the pages of a novel, it was clear that the human self was heterogeneous, not homogeneous. Not one thing, but many, multiple, fractured, and contradictory. The person you were for your parents was not the person you were with your children. Your working self was other than yourself as a lover. And depending on the time of day and your mood, you might think of yourself as tall or skinny or unwell or a sports fan or conservative or fearful or hot. All writers and readers knew that human beings had broad identities, not narrow ones. And it was the breadth of human nature that allowed readers to find common ground and points of identification with Madame Bovary, Leopold Bloom, Colonel Aureliano Buendia, Raskolnikov, Gandalf the Grey, Oscar Mazzarat, the Macioka sisters, the Continental Op, the Earl of Emsworth, Miss Marple, the Baron in the Trees, and Salo, the mechanical messenger from the planet Tralfamador in Kurt Vonnegut's Sirens of Titan. Readers and writers could take that knowledge of broad-based identity out into the world beyond the pages of books and use the knowledge to find common ground with their fellow human beings. You could support different football teams but vote the same way. You could vote for different parties but agree about the best way to raise your children. You could disagree about child rearing but share a fear of the dark. You could be afraid of different things but love the same music. You could detest each other's musical taste, but worship the same God. You could differ strongly on the question of religion, but support the same football team. This was what literature knew, had always known. I'll stop there.
We're going to talk about memoirs for 10 minutes or so and then open it out to the audience. Samar.
Yeah. 2 days in the life of Ivan Denisovich. Sorry.
What was that other very good one? Oh, the Big Gatsby?
The Big Gatsby, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and actually, that's how we came up with Hitch 22, which, as a kind of failure for Catch 22, which Christopher ended up using as the title of his autobiography, his memoir.
Now, there is something. I've written a memoir too, and there are some things we've already talked about and agreed about. For instance, that a memoir comes about twice as fast as a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the structure is there. You don't make up. You don't have to make up what happened. You have to present it. And I thought, as I sat down to write, to begin, that it was a search for tone. And in a way, all writing is a search for tone. But more intensely because you're presenting yourself. Now, when I read your book, Joseph Anton, which I loved, as you know, I couldn't believe how much you were going to lay yourself open. I said nothing about, very little about love life. Nothing at all about money. That may be sort of English reserve, and someone sort of more.
I didn't say a lot about money.
A bit about it.
I said a lot about sex.
Yeah, but if you're English, you don't mention that. And in fact, you never do in conversation.
No.
And we sort of look down our noses at people who go on about how much money they earn, or anything to do with money at all. But you're perhaps a little bit more used to America, where it's, as Newt Gingrich said, I think it's okay to make money. But English people don't think it's okay.
Yes, and they don't like it if you do. They don't like it if they do.
No.
But one of the reasons that there is some financial matter in the book is that the financial matter became very important in those years, because it was very, very expensive to set up the defense against the fatwa. You know, I mean, I had to pay for all my own houses and so on. The idea that there were government safe houses, which I was suddenly given, was just not true. And I remember at one point saying to one of the senior police officers, I said, you know, supposing that the Satanic Verses had been a poem, you know, and supposing that the author had the kind of resources normally possessed by poets, you know, how would you have done this?
And he said, "Well, Armored Garrett."
He said, "Well, fortunately, we don't have to answer that question, do we, sir?" In other words, they had no idea how they would have done it, you know. And meanwhile, I was being accused in the papers on a more or less daily basis of costing the country a lot of money.
Taxpayers' money.
Taxpayers' money, because of something that I had brought on myself. You know, so the money subject was very much.
Yeah. No,
up front there, you know?
I'm just saying that you decided to be incredibly candid with the reader.
But I thought, otherwise don't write the book, you know. Because of this, I guess, sort of novelistic instinct, if you're going to create a character on the page, even if that character is yourself, the reader needs to know everything about the character.
Yeah.
You know? And if you conceal from the reader very important material about the character, then the character is only partially alive on the page. And I thought that's what, you know, my novelist's instinct said, write about myself in the round. I mean, fully, you know. Otherwise, don't do it. Nobody's making you do it, you know. Keep your mouth shut, stay home, write another novel. But if you're going to do it, I mean, it's the principle established by Rousseau, where he said, you know, tell as much truth as possible. And sometimes it's painful, and sometimes it's embarrassing, and sometimes it's excessively vulnerable. And, I mean, it is what was a bit like undressing in public, writing this book. You know, it was a bit like being sort of naked in the town square.
What made you feel the time was right? All I felt was that when my father died, and I didn't feel like writing fiction at that time, and I just thought, I'd always felt that because he was a writer too, and we were, you know, rough parity as writers, and that's incredibly rare, and in all languages, I just thought I'd have to account for it.
But your book's not—it's not only about your father. I mean, it's about other things in your life too. And again,
but that was what made me feel I could write it there.
Yeah. And some of those things were not immediate. I mean, they'd been a while ago. You know, and I mean, I thought that's what I waited for was until I had enough distance from it. You know, because I think there was a point after. You know, the book ends in kind of early 2002, which was the last moment at which there was any real requirement for police protection and security and so on.
That's the closing moment, but you do, in fact, go beyond that.
Yeah, but that's the kind of the end moment, you know. And I wanted to be confident that it was the end. You know what I mean? There was a point during the course of those years when I found an interview some TV interview in which somebody had said to me, are you ever going to write about this? And I said, I can't write about it because I don't know the last chapter. You know? And I mean, I didn't even know, I mean, I have no way of knowing if the last chapter was going to be, you know, a happy ending or not. or if indeed I would be the person who would be able to write the book or not. You know, there were all these very dark questions which were unanswered, you know, and I needed them to be answered. And then I needed to feel far enough away from the event to be able to look at it and write about it as a writer rather than as somebody still overly in the emotional power of the event.
Well, you made me believe in that completely lousy and useless word, closure, which I've written elsewhere saying that it's a chimera because no one ever gets over anything. But
yes, closure is what happens to doors.
Yeah. But I did feel that, that there was a certain sense that that was, well, like another life.
You know, one of the things I felt is that I just, it does, in my mind, draw a line under those years, if only because I think, you know, like once this paperback's out and so on, I really think I will never have to talk about it again. And any time anybody, I mean, you know, I've had this problem for 25 years of journalists really wanting to ask about it every single time I publish a book, even if the book has nothing to do with that. And now I can just, you know, throw a 600-page book at them and say, you know, it's answers in there. It's all in there. Read that. You know, so that's my view. This is my answer to every question I've ever been asked on the subject. Enough already.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, time to make shit up.
It's a wonderful thing to get back to a novel after a memoir.
Wonderful. Wonderful. It really
liberating. The freedom.
Yeah. I don't know what happened. Which was the book you wrote after Experience?
Can't remember.
It's come to this. Two old geezers sitting on a stage, unable to remember the sequence of their own books.
Well, I remember, I had a sort of tussle with this in that I tried to write an autobiographical novel about the sexual revolution. And John Banville, the Irish writer, said, "It's impossible." And I said, "Well, yeah, but it's sort of something nice about attempting the impossible." And I wasted about 2 years later,
I remember you were calling us up, telling us we were going to be in it.
Yeah.
I remember that. And he said,
I thought, I'm going to stop making it autobiographical. In fact, I'm going to change the main character into the opposite of me, an illegitimate orphan, rather than someone with a, you know, writer father. And then the joy of the freedom, and, you know, fiction is freedom. The memoir is a more restricted space.
Yeah, well, you feel a responsibility to the truth, you know. You feel, I mean, certainly I felt that I'm really going to try and say what, as far as I can do it and as far as I'm able to express it, here's what really happened to me and to the people around me and to my publishers and my, you know, and all the people who were involved in this matter. Just say what, because there were so many spurious rumors circulating, you know, so much untruth masquerading as truth, you know, so much truthiness, to use George W. Bush's favorite word. You know, there was a story, I mean, you know, there was, as you know, there was a point where, once or twice, where we met at Ian McEwan's place in the countryside. And so then, and Ian said this to some journalist, and suddenly there were these articles about how I had lived in Ian's house all the time, all those years. And, you know, I went for a weekend to stay with a friend in Dublin, and suddenly, you know, he had sheltered me. This was an Irish pop star. That he had sheltered me for 10 years. You know, as opposed to a weekend. And I just thought, before this truthiness becomes established as you know, kind of factoid, I'd like to present some actual information. But it did, after that, it's made me have a very bad overreaction against factuality. You know, it's like I've been over here trying to tell the truth, and now I want to go vroom, over here, and I think I'm suddenly gripped by surrealism and sort of absurd, crazy, implausible invention.
Levitating purple donkeys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Actually, I hadn't got any of them in yet.
Well, isn't that magical realism?
No, I don't think it is. Magical, you see, this technique, the technique of breaking the rules of naturalism, has been around as long as literature has been around. You know, and if you grew up in India, you grew up with wonderful tales. You grew up with the Arabian Nights and the Panchatantra fables and the Mahabharata and the Ramayana and etc. You know, and French surrealism, American fabulism, South American magic realism.
Which is very old.
It's all the same thing. Old, yeah. It's all the same thing. It's just gets different names in different places. It's basically a love of the fictionality of fiction, you know, and the understanding that it's all untrue. That, you know, Madame Bovary and a magic carpet, they're both untrue. You know, and Madame Bovary is untrue in the same degree as the flying carpet is untrue. She never existed. You know, there was no such person, and carpets don't fly. You know, once you know that, you're free. You know, and you can use your, you know, it's a way of putting the dreaming consciousness into the center of the page.
But nonetheless, I agree with everything you've said. Nonetheless, the whole weight of literature, it does tend to be social realism.
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, there's a wonderful essay by Kundera about this, where he says that the novel has two parents, and which he identifies as Samuel Richardson's Clarissa and Sterne's Tristram Shandy. And he says that, you know, essentially the children of Clarissa have populated the earth, you know, the realist tradition. And Tristram Shandy, anyway, has some problem in the child-producing department. But, you know, there are this little stunted line of inheritance of Tristram Shandy's descendants. But Kundera says that he has the impression that all the interesting work that can be done is actually over there in the Tristram Shandy family, whereas the realist tradition is, you know, I'm paraphrasing it, but he says is sort of exhausted. Because it's all been done before. The place where there are things which haven't been done before is over on the other side.
Except that social realism is responding to a changing reality more closely than the bee.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, it doesn't have to be levitating purple donkeys. But I think the tradition of the fantastic is a way, very precisely, of responding to a transforming world, to a metamorphic world in which we don't understand the rules anymore. And I think we all have that sense of living in a world that's just changing out of all recognition every day, and we don't get it anymore. You know?
All right. Well, but I would say that the successes of the surreal are many fewer.
Very few. No, it's very difficult to do it. Very easy to do badly.
And also another principle that I think is pretty rock solid, Dr. Johnson, nothing odd will do long.
The second sentence of that is Tristram Shandy will not last.
It hasn't lasted. It never got started with me.
Well, I would bet you small amount of money that there's more people reading Tristram Shandy than Dr. Johnson.
You've got to compare it with Henry Fielding, not Dr. Johnson.
I'm happy with them both. And actually, sure, Henry Fielding is the comic tradition. It's not really, I mean, it's very heightened and you know, almost comical, cartoonish in certain places, Tom Jones. You know, it's not Flaubertian. You know, it's more Quentin Tarantino than that, you know.
All right, but fine. Take Kafka, who's the greatest in this line. Mm. But he wrote three novels that you could just chuck out of the window without diminishing him at all. He couldn't.
Which three would those be?
The Trial.
Oh, you Castle, could chuck those out of the window.
America.
He says this stuff. he says, of course, Samuel Beckett's no fucking good at all. No, he says this stuff. He says all theatre is awful.
Except Shakespeare. hang on. He couldn't finish his novels, and neither can we. And there's something about the dreamlike form
the sort of marvelous inconsequentiality of the dreamlike form that is intolerable after about 30 pages. Well, and that's why The Metamorphosis is 30 pages. The Hunger Artist, in the Penal Colony, all those great works are all, you know, 20 pages.
Well, you're right about the power of the short form in Kafka, but boy, you know, when you're wrong, you're really wrong. I think one of the great things about The Castle, for example, is that it's a novel in which every individual scene is cast as comedy. Every individual scene is written as comedy.
True.
And the collective effect of it is the opposite of comedy. It's the so-called Kafkaesque, or what we've come to call the Kafkaesque. He didn't call it that.
It's Kafkaesque.
Yeah. No, we're not going to agree. He says Dostoevsky's no good.
That's a bit sweeping. A trifle too sweeping.
So Martin is magnificent in his condemnations, you know.
Well, I got into a great deal of trouble when my children, too, when I was asked if I'd ever write a children's book. You know, we've had this argument. And I said, it was at a public thing, and I said, I could well write a children's book if I had a serious head injury. And then... Yeah.
Like Lewis Carroll or E.B. White. Yeah.
And then every children's book writer in the world had a fit of self-righteousness. And my daughters came home from school saying, "You said a terrible thing."
Well, speaking as somebody who
has written,
has concealed his serious head injury for a while. I mean, for me, the two books I wrote for, they're not exactly children, I mean, they're young adult books, really, but they're sort of like the most fun I ever had as a writer, you know? And I think I was using most of my mind.
Although I did quote at you when you said you, after the fact, well, you couldn't write it.
No, that's true. That's true. I mean, it took me a long time to gather the strength to write a big adult novel.
Yeah. He said, you know, I have so many distractions, sit down at my desk, and by the time I'd work through the distractions in my head, I'd be wrecked, he said.
Yeah.
And I would concede that actually the child's mind is infinite in a way. So I'm not...
I mean, Raymond Carver used to say that he wrote short stories because he didn't have time to write novels. You know, that he was... Because he was very busy, you know, surviving for a long time and paying the bills and so on, and had to write in the dark of the night when his screaming children were asleep and so on. Sometimes the physical circumstances of the writer do determine what the writer can do. I mean, not only the writer, I remember being I only met the painter Francis Bacon on one occasion, and I was having dinner sitting next to him. We deeply bonded over the fact that we're both asthmatic. We both produced our asthma inhalers at the same time and immediately became friends. And I asked him, I thought rather daringly, about his frequent use of the triptych, you know, that there's so many Bacons which are three things side by side. And I said, what is that, you know? And he said, well, my studio is upstairs at the top of the house, and there's quite a narrow staircase. And the maximum size of canvas I can get up there, you know, is about this big. And he said, sometimes I want to do something bigger than that, so I do three. And I thought, you know, that's probably is the absolute truth about why Francis Bacon painted so many triptychs, even though there are great volumes of art criticism written about it, you know, sort of octo bullshit criticism. Yeah. Anyway, we're being interrupted.
Yes. So I hate to interrupt this colloquy. We've got a few minutes for questions. I think most of you know how this works. Raise your hand. We'll get you a mic. You can ask a question of the author of Dead Infants or The Devilish Verses on My Left, sir.
So I'm interested in the choice of the third person as a tool of revelation, as it turns out, because while you were reading, especially the section on the Twin Towers and its aftermath, I was thinking about Henry Adams, who used the third person to conceal far more than to reveal.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could just comment
on
that.
For me, it felt like the key that unlocked the book for me when I tried that. Because I started writing it in the first person, and I didn't like the sound of it. You know, it felt, it felt narcissistic, you know? I, me, I thought this happened to me, I felt, he said to me, I said, shut up, you know? and then there was just a moment where I thought, I thought in a first-person memoir, the person called I acquires a slightly different quality than the people called he and she, you know? And I thought, if I banish that, if there isn't an I, there are only he and she, then all the characters exist at the same level of reality, you know? And then I can write about them novelistically, you know? And I tried it, and I immediately thought, oh, I think I know how to do this, and did it. It's not the first time. I mean, you say Henry Adams. Christopher Isherwood wrote a very good memoir called Christopher and His Friends in the third person. There's a bit of Coetzee, which has tried to use the third person in memoir form as well. So it's, you know...
Isn't it also gives you a bit of space? When you're dithering, beginning a novel between third person, the kind of third person that never leaves that character, so it's proxy first person. But if you go into first person, it's like a zoom in a film. You're sort of... You go in.
Yeah.
And with the third person, I felt you constantly benefited from this. There's a bit more...
There's distant, a step back. Yeah. I wanted to say there's a step of distance between the me writing the book and the me being written about. For various reasons. First of all, the me being written about is a quarter of a century younger. You know, and is someone to whom this hasn't happened yet. You know, so it's kind of innocent of the future, you know, whereas the author writing the book knows what's coming, you know. And then also the author writing the book now is in a happier place, you know, is less burdened by it. I mean, you remember, you know, I was not always in great shape in those years, you know, in the head and just emotionally, and it was very burdensome emotionally. And
You were up and down, but you were strong, right?
Well, I hope so. I didn't completely fall apart ever, I think, except on brief occasions when nobody was there. You know, in the bathroom. That's the place to fall apart. as we all know. but, you know, I did feel just that the character of myself in my early 40s differed in little but important ways from myself in my mid-60s writing about that moment. And again, the third person helped make that distance.
Yeah.
Another question. Yes, gentleman on the aisle here.
Could I please ask each of you to share with us the titles of a memoir or two that you admire, and maybe say a word or two about why you would recommend it for us?
I once read about... Isaac Asimov's two-volume memoir, sort of 1,000 pages in all. I was interviewing him, so I had to read it. and here was a really skillless use of diaries, whereas Salman's was a very skillful use of diaries. But I said that he's such a faithful day-by-day account of his life, that it made the average book of showbiz memoirs look like Speak Memory. And in fact, Speak Memory, it must be the greatest memoir.
You have to say that.
And it's great for this reason, I think, that not only is it sort of beautifully written, by the way, despite an appalling chapter about his ancestry, and Updike did the same thing in his Self-Consciousness. With Nabokov, it's all about how his mother comes from an 8th-century family, and, you know, why don't I say 3rd-century, you know, B.C., you know. And Updike, with his filthy John Oopendoot, who owned all of Staten Island. All that stuff is terrible. But the rest of Speak Memory is beautiful and immortal because it's not his. It's not the history of the person. It's the history of the talent. So yeah. It's of a whole level of refinement over and above what you find anywhere else.
I absolutely agree about Nabokov, and also about that ancestry chapter, which is embarrassing. You know, why not go back to the Cro-Magnon era, you know?
My Neanderthal.
Yeah, my Iron Age parents. rode on dinosaurs.
The African Eve.
Exactly. And other than that, best memoir ever written. There's one very complex but very rewarding memoir, which is Elias Canetti's memoir of a Sephardic childhood in Eastern Europe, which is called The Tongue Set Free. And it's long and complicated and kind of very beautiful if you read it in small bits. And there's a sequel to that. But that's, I think, the first volume is very good. And what else? I mean, you know, Susan Sontag kept very detailed diaries, but wrote them for publication very clearly. You know, she would write a certain amount of hours every day on her journal, and it was very written, you know. And now these are coming out, the selections from her diaries, and they are a remarkable intellectual portrait of an age, you know, and of, as you say, of her own talent, of her own development. It's not very personal, her stuff, but it is wonderful about the development of her mind, you know, and her thought, and fantastic for that. I mean, it may be the best thing she wrote, I mean, along with some of the great essays. She was always very pissed off if you didn't think she was a great novelist. You know, I mean, the first time I ever met her, and I complimented her on, you know, illness as metaphor, or on photography, or something like that. And she said, "Admit it, Salman, you've never read a single word of any fiction I've ever written." Which wasn't true, I had, and that's why I wasn't mentioning it. But she is a great memoirist.
Why don't we end with a question by a lady on the aisle there in the green.
Salman Rushdie, thank you for that very personal memoir. I feel that I really know you. And Martin Amis, the lobster scene was the funniest scene I've ever read in literature. And Lionel Aspel was the most despicable character I've ever read in literature. Would you be willing to tell us about your inspiration, if any, for this character?
Just to say that... general principle. I adore Lionel. Worship the ground he walks on. But that's true of all my characters. The most horrible. He wasn't very difficult to do, funnily enough. And I'd done three or four male monsters before him. And I knew I could do that. But the difficult one was the goody. Desmond. And this is just a sort of an interesting thing started up recently about whether characters should be likable. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
I don't think that likable is the right word. It's whether you want to see them on the next page, whether in fact you're going ahead a page or two, hoping they're going to return. Likable is the wrong idea.
It's a little ingratiating.
And it means cute, and you don't want that. But, you know, you accept that the covers of a novel are like the bars of a cage, and you can go to the zoo and see, you know, the beautiful severity of the tiger with its green eyes and terrifying fangs, and no harm can come to you. And that's what the novel is like. So likable is too bland, and you get that terrible sort of up-your-ass writing where lots of little contemporary jokes and vulgarisms that are meant to put you at your ease, you know, and in fact are repellent to a writer with any, a reader with any discernment. So the bad character has an immediate appeal for that reason. And the good character, Montalon said, happiness writes white, goodness writes white. Much more of a challenge to make the good character live on the page.
No, I mean, Iago much more interesting than Othello.
Much more?
Interesting than Othello as a character.
Iago.
More fun to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, just you can see this in other forms too, you know. You know, Bambi's likable. and Hannibal Lecter is not, you know.
But who
would you rather spend an evening with in the cinema? You know, I'm not saying who would you rather have in your home. That's a more complicated question, but just, you know, they're only in movies. And in the same way in books, you know, there are, I mean, even in very great novels, I mean, you think of, you know, the character of Marcel in Proust's great supernovel, In Search of Lost Time. If you really think about Marcel, he's insufferable. I mean, he's a sort of snob and social climber, and, you know, he's kind of zelig in French, you know, and it's easy to be very critical of him as a person, but he's not a person. He's our way into this wonderful world, you know, and it contains multitudes, you know, as Whitman said. And for that, we're grateful to him. I mean, there's a moment at the end of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man where Stephen Dedalus says at the end, the kind of envoi of the novel is that he's sort of going forth into the world, he says, to forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated conscience of my race. And you think, asshole.
A perfect place to end. Please join me in thanking Martin Amis and Salman Rushdie.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.